My name's Bob Gay. For many years, I was on the staff of the Federal Reserve during the Volcker years and worked extensively on the staff forecast. It was one of my primary responsibilities. Then there was a vast amount of data, but on the other hand, the U.S. economy was much more domestic oriented than it is today. So the challenges facing you in deciding on the outlook and your investment alternatives is formidable, and I can appreciate that. And I've learned from my experience in forecasting, especially at the Fed, that one of the best ways of avoiding groupthink is to consider some fairly radically different outcomes. And that's what we're going to try to do today with some separate scenarios that look, I hope, sufficiently different to cause you to make alternative investment decisions. Now, before I start, I want to mention just a couple of points about how the world has changed, I think, quite dramatically, especially in the last 20 years. Now, these are four things. A couple of them are something economists don't often consider. Others are more technical points about how macroeconomics has changed. But they really are effective no matter what your scenario. These are four items that, in my opinion, aren't going away regardless. So I offer them up to you as a preamble, just for your considerations. Their investment implications are not obvious, at least they're not obvious to me, but they may color your opinion of how to weight the scenarios or how to weight the financial outcomes given the scenario. So first, let me go to those four points. And first is demographics. You all are aware that demographics are changing, but it's no longer a small event. It used to be just Japan was aging very rapidly. It's not just Japan's working age population that is shrinking. It is now includes China. It includes Europe in aggregate. This is no longer a small amount of the world economy. It is no longer a small amount of the world's GDP, and it's happening now as we speak. This year, they're turning over and heading south on those demographics. And of course, that has implications for growth and whatever. The second one is income inequality. Now, economists don't like to consider income inequality. It messes up their models and whatnot. But in my mind, such a dramatic shift as we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is worth contemplating the implications, especially for financial markets. It's income inequality within countries that has ballooned, and it has risen in many countries, not just a few, but many countries, to the heights that it was prior to the Great Depression in the 1930s. So this one, I think, is one worth considering. It also has implications for growth, namely, high income inequality has been historically associated with lower potential growth rates for simple reasons. Rich people save a lot more money and it doesn't necessarily get invested. It may get invested in financial assets, but not necessarily real assets that contribute to potential GDP. So that I would offer you as a second consideration. A third is a somewhat technical point. And that is that the Phillips curve has been much flatter in the last 10 years than it has certainly from when the years when I was at the Fed. The simple implication is that policy actions don't give you the bang for the buck that they used to. In particular, monetary policy doesn't give you the bang for the buck that it used to. And I express this in terms of a chart that relates output gap to inflation. And essentially what you see is that the inflation chart is sort of dribbling off on the right-hand side with no volatility, while the other line, the output gap line, seems to be gyrating just as much as it ever does, especially during the global recession of 2007. And yet you've got very little a price action on inflation one way or the other. So not only is disinflation kind of set and probably here to stay for quite a while, but the volatility inflation is also probably going to be quite low for quite some time. There's many explanations for this in terms of globalization, technology, and other considerations. But my point being is it seems to be here to stay for a while. And the last one is central banks are finding it very difficult, at least in advanced countries, to fight inflation from below target. In fact, they openly admit to having difficulties fighting inflation from below target. Now, of course, that is quite nerve-wracking to a central banker because one step from too low inflation is deflation. And deflation is probably the worst possible outcome that a central banker could face. So they're very wary about inflation getting too low and would like it to have at least a meaningful number like 2% so that they have a bit of cushion to avoid deflation. But they openly admit that monetary policy just isn't as potent as it used to be at those low interest rates. And indeed, you can consider the Fed's latest action as basically a preemptive strike against anything that might set them off course in the coming year or two. And they wish to get ahead of the curve, but ahead of the curve in a different sense, meaning ahead of the curve on the downside. So with those four things in mind, let's consider some scenarios. And the first scenario is what I call the return to normalcy, the neutral, it's fairly neutral for investment policy, but it is what I hope would be a new norm. And the keys to a new norm is, of course, some sense of stability in the major countries. And for the US, there are some very telltale signs that things are still fairly normal, at least at this moment. That can change, but right now they seem fairly normal. For one, for the first time in years, the last year or so, wages have been rising more than inflation. And that, of course, is a support to real incomes and, of course, to household spending. Likewise, hiring. Hiring still is faring pretty well. Layoffs are de minimis. Unemployment claims are all-time lows. So there seems to be still some momentum, at least on the household side, to keep the economy on track. I don't say necessarily on track for a number like 3%, but surely on track for a number like potential growth, which the Fed thinks is around 2%. It is true that now that wages are rising, you might get some compression of margins. Firms are reluctant to raise prices because of all the competition in the world. So there is some sense that margins might be squeezed a bit, but margins are very, very high by historical standards. So that doesn't seem much of a dramatic change. But to reach this scenario, I think you have to presume that the trade tensions and the retaliatory measures that you see and hear almost every day wane, they get resolved, they come to some sort of settlements among countries to get to new trade relationships. Growth in inflation outside the U.S., are not what they used to be. Europe is particularly disappointing, and I think that the tensions in trade legislations probably have left some residual scarring. China, in its sake, is a little reluctant to overstimulate the way it did back in 2013-14. So there have been changes, and there have been changes in mentalities because of those tensions. But I think as long as they wane and they are resolved in some satisfactory manner, it is certainly possible to get to a normal, back to normal in some sense. In that case, I would expect the Fed to revert to normal. I expect the Fed funds rate to return to something like its neutral level. And the Fed has told you that neutral, in its mind, is something in the neighborhood of a nominal rate of 2.5%. In other words, a real rate of about 0.5%. And they've told you that in their research. And indeed, that's exactly where they were, or thought they were, until this past month. Elsewhere, I think normalization would proceed more slowly. There would be, I think, some upward pressure on the U.S. dollar because other countries are lagging behind the U.S. So I do think that's a consideration, but I also think that commodity prices would stabilize, perhaps not at the high levels they've been in recent years, but I would expect them to stabilize. For the Australia, I think the normalcy scenario leads the RBA to end up what I think is their neutral rate of about 1.5% for the cash rate. Now, of course, it's only 1%. So I do think they might back up. But to date, of course, central banks have been very active in following each other. I think they would, with a return to normalcy, follow each other back to some neutral as well. So that's the neutral scenario, the base case, if you will. And I hope that's realistic. I think it is realistic, and certainly it should be considered as a possibility. Let's turn now to scenario number two. And that's we might call it the isolationism, U.S. isolationism scenario. It's the bear scenario. Bear scenario from natural markets, bear scenario for economies. It doesn't necessarily mean we have a global recession, but it might. So let's consider what gets us there. And certainly it would mean that countries continue to fight about trade issues. And in this case, the U.S. would be, which has been the initiator of many of these tensions, I think would be continuing to do so. And very importantly, other countries would have to retaliate in a commensurate measure. I don't say they do the same thing. I'm just saying somewhat commensurate in terms of its toll on the cost of doing trade around the world, global trade, if you will. Global trade was for at least the last 20 years, been one of the major sources of global growth. I'd estimate that expansion of global trade contributed at least 0.25 to 0.5 percentage point to global GDP growth. That doesn't sound like a big number, but it feels a lot bigger when you go the other way to a negative number. That's a flip of a considerable magnitude. And we'd have to consider that as a fairly serious outcome. And of course, the reason it can be much higher is because when you start impairing global trade, you also start to disrupt global supply chains. You also disrupt business decisions and pricing decisions. In this scenario, excuse me, all economies suffer. And there've been a lot of studies on how much economies would suffer. I'm showing you here the results of an OECD study. It was done when Catherine Mann, an ex-Fed colleague of mine, was the chief economist at OECD. Catherine was one of the finest economists at the Fed when I was there, and she's continued in a very illustrious career. So I have good faith in the sort of simulation that she has done with global trade data here. What surprises you in this chart is not how much imports are affected, especially in the U.S., but how much exports are affected. Major disruption to U.S. exports, and in this scenario, which is a 10% increase in the cost of trade. Now, that could be a tariff, but then it would have to be a tariff on everybody, But it could just be retaliation in kind. It doesn't have to be the same thing. It just has to be of similar sort of size. But it has to affect most everybody. But 10%, on the other hand, is not a very big number. And what you get here is a negative effect on global growth of more than 1.5 percentage points of GDP. That's basically would cut it in half almost. For the US, you lose 2.5 percentage points of growth. That would pretty much wipe out the whole thing that we've got right now. Exports hurt more than imports, so our trade deficit would get worse. The second one, again, not so surprisingly, is China. China is hurt badly because they are highly integrated into the world economy now. And their exports go all over the world and they import from all over the world. So the magnitudes are quite large for the countries that matter most in terms of their leading the current global economy in growth. China and the US are the big engines of growth right now. So the fact that trade wars actually hurt the two leaders is quite problematic. In this scenario, the central banks, of course, respond. They respond by a loosening policy. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, they have trouble stimulating growth at such low interest rates. Monetary policy is relatively ineffectual. So they would have to go to other measures. And the other measures would extend, like during the global crisis, the Fed would have to extend credit lines to many emerging countries so that their trade finance wasn't cut off. You would have to see a lot of positive actions, especially by the Federal Reserve, in order to kind of shortcut the rapid degeneration in activity. And the rapid deceleration and the rapid effect on economies comes from the credit line. It is not necessarily about what you would think is the macroeconomic effects alone. It's when credit lines shut down that the global economy starts to shut down. The idea that these tariffs and other impediments to trade don't have costs or don't have immediate consequences, I think is a bit naive though. The manufacturing data already has turned south, and it's not just a few countries. As you can see, the global PMIs over the past year have retraced all of the increase since the low ebb of 2013, which is on the left-hand side. Note, of course, on the left-hand side, the high correlation between the manufacturing ISMs and PMIs, ISM in the US, and global growth. In fact, it's surprisingly strong. Surprisingly strong, I say, because manufacturing is not as large a part of the world economy as it used to be, and certainly it's not as much as the US economy or even the Australian economy as it once was. So how is it that this tail wags the dog? But it does, and it does in part because of the repercussions on other sectors that go keep rolling, especially when it starts to get to the credit channel, and credit itself becomes impaired, and companies start to have bad loans, and banks start to pull in their horns. If the credit channel does choke off the world economy to a much greater extent than just the trade impediments that we see today, then the debtor countries in particular are challenged and indeed face potential payments crisis. A handy little measure of that, and one that I found in my experience to be extremely telltale in that regard, is the net foreign liabilities of the country. And of course, how much of that those net foreign liabilities are paid for with short-term debt. And this little chart I've shown you here shows you net foreign liabilities as a percent of GDP. The IMF did a study that showed that countries that have net foreign liabilities less than 50% of GDP almost never default. And that makes sense because other people owe them a lot of money, so they're usually pretty keen on paying their debts. But if you are beyond that 50% threshold, the probability of a payments crisis rises somewhat exponentially. And some countries on the right-hand side of this chart still have very large net foreign liabilities. You'll notice that New Zealand and Australia look like they're on the right-hand side, but to their enormous credit, both of them have reduced their net foreign liabilities since the date of this chart, which was about 2014-15. So in both Australia and New Zealand's case, they've actually improved their net foreign position, which is quite extraordinary and to their credit. You can see here, the one thing that is in the market that's obvious is that credit spreads and equities are highly correlated and highly coincident. And that's telling you that, of course, the credit world is very concerned about debtor nations and debtor companies. So liquidity becomes extremely important. And the flip side is that countries that are teetering on financial difficulties, ones like Venezuela, Argentina, or Turkey, are really at risk of having payments crisis. Safe havens in this scenario do get some extra kick, namely, usually in their fixed income. People think it's the safe place to be or the only safe haven, things like Japanese yen and US dollar, and of course, the US Treasury market. That was the case in 2009 as well. But what you're most concerned about is what happens to banks and whether banks have to pull in their horns create a shortage of credit availability. Credit availability, or the lack thereof, is what transforms macroeconomic downturns into major recessions. And it comes because bad loans accumulate, banks tighten their lending standards, and as I showed, I believe, in an earlier chart of the US, there is no signs yet of US banks tightening their lending standards. Australia has a survey about lending standards, and Europe has some as well. So those statistics are well worth watching to consider how far you're moving along in this particular scenario. What tends to dry up is not just loans and trade finance, but it also is reflected in the commercial paper markets. They get hammered, quite frankly. And that, of course, means the funding for banks becomes stressed and it becomes a bit of a vicious circle. Now, Australia would, of course, suffer from the deterioration of the terms of trade. Commodity prices would decline, but from fairly high levels. I consider current levels quite high. RBA would cut its policy rate, its cash rate, right down to the lower bound. And that would, of course, help refinancing of the household debt burden, which is somewhat sizable. Unlike the past, though, I think Australia is in much better shape than, for example, it was back in 2008. Your budget deficit has almost disappeared. Whether or not you believe there'll be surpluses in the coming year, you are in a whole lot better position than a lot of countries in the world, a lot of countries in Europe, and of course the US. So there's plenty of room for fiscal stimulus, especially given that your the financing cost of your debt is virtually free with bond yields at 1%. So I don't think the currency or the economy is quite as vulnerable as it was during past downturns, especially if they become severe. I don't think Australia is hit quite as hard as in the past. And it's, I think it's quite striking, and I'm quite impressed that your relatively small current account deficit, in many of the years I've watched Australia, you've always had a current account deficit that was fairly sizable. It's now quite small, and it has almost no short-term financing. It's the short-term financing of current account deficits that are the hammer that crushes the weak debtor countries. So now let's turn to the third scenario. It's the bullish scenario. It's, you can call it global reflation. You clearly would have to have a resolution of the trade disputes. I don't think there's any question about that. You'd have to have some sort of agreements that seemed sustainable, or that we would each, that the countries would at least honor for some time. Tariffs would probably have to be unwound. Financial conditions, of course, would improve, especially with respect to trade financing. Again, depending on the depth of the downside which may be de minimis, it conditions your view of how high the upside is. But I do think there is room for this record long economic cycle to be sustained, but it needs, in my opinion, a new source of stimulus, namely one that is not globalization, one that is not just purely technology driven. One possibility, of course, is that central banks will keep their policy rates at very low levels for a long time. It's almost uniform across the board. There's hardly any major central banks in the world now that have anything remotely close to a tight monetary policy, and it doesn't look like they're moving away from that anytime soon. So I think that is the setting for a possible reflation. But I think you still need some engine of growth. In my opinion, you can make your choice of what it might be. I don't think they're entirely fanciful. Clamoring for dealing with climate change is greater than ever. The pressure on governments, and including the United States, to do something about climate change is greater than others. That is certainly a potential. Infrastructure everywhere is aging. Almost any country in the world could do for some repairing of infrastructure. But governments would have to focus far more on the investment part of their budgets rather than the other parts which have driven them so far. You also could imagine a scenario where technology drives a remarkable improvement in productivity in the service sector. In many service sectors, you could see some sort of that happening in the years ahead. In this scenario, of course, I do think commodity prices remain high. And for Australia, of course, that's very favorable. It's also very favorable for attracting fixed income to your resources, which are plentiful. So I think the bullish scenario is actually quite bullish for Australia, because you're winning on both sides of the balance. You're winning on both your resource prices, and you're winning on the ability of the government to provide dual stimulus, both fiscal and monetary policy. It, of course, just takes the political will and commitment to do so. So I actually am for the bullish scenario, I'm actually quite bullish on Australia itself. I think for some other regions of the world, it's fairly challenging, especially Europe. But we don't need the entire world to be growing at 3, 4, 5%. We don't need numbers like that to have a bullish scenario, in my opinion. With that, I hope I've presented some sufficiently different scenarios so that you can consider, one, their probability, and one, what is the investment implications of those scenarios, which again, I say, is not entirely obvious to me yet, but I look forward to your deliberations and seeing what you come up